This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And I have been having so much fun this past month with so many wonderful guests from National Geographic, and they have been just a great group of authors and editors to talk about the wonderful gift books that are available from National Geographic. So today I am really, really thrilled to welcome to Joy on Paper someone who I admire so much because I was a part of this wonderful, wonderful mission that we created in our space age, and it was about the Apollo mission. And so I'm happy to welcome to the program, I hope I pronounced your name right, Teasel Muir Harmony. Hi.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
Did I say it right?
You did, yes.
Okay, Teasel. Well, Dr. Muir Harmony, it is such an honor to have you on the program. You are really quite amazing, and as a curator of the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, you have come out with it's my favorite book of the year, I think, because I was, as I mentioned, just a little bit involved in the Apollo story, and so it's really exciting to have you, and the book that you've written is called Apollo to the Moon, A History in 50 Objects. Of course, it's a Nat Geo book. It's absolutely stunning.
Oh, thank you so much. I really enjoyed working on it, so it's great to hear that you liked reading it and looking through it.
Well, as always, Nat Geo books are beautiful, but this one is particularly beautiful. It is really a collector's item because the paper, the production value is so high, and so it is a book that anyone who gets this book will treasure.
Oh, thank you.
Well, as I mentioned, I was I was a screenwriter, and I was tasked with the really fun project of writing the script for Apollo astronaut Walt Cunningham's book called The All-American Boys. Now, he was, of course, on Apollo 7, and he wrote a book, and I'm holding it up to the camera. We're on YouTube at the moment, so I can hold it up for people to see. And I was thrilled to be given this assignment because I got to spend many, many hours with Walt, working on you know, the story and getting all the backstory, and I had the joy of getting one of those really great backstage tours of Johnson Space Center, and I got to see all of the objects back there, and I got to touch things and do things with, you know, that most people never got to do, and it was so exciting for me. So I have just. Anything to do with Apollo has always interested me.
Oh, that's wonderful. I got to meet him this fall when we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 7 mission. He came to the Smithsonian. It was wonderful to spend the morning with him.
Well, he is delightful. As I said, because when I got the book, I didn't know anything about the space, you know, race, and other than the joy of having, you know, been aware of it, but when I got to meet him, and then I was also so thrilled. Alan Bean also contributed a great deal to the script because he invited me to his home and spent a lot of time with me talking about those days. And so I got all this backstage information, and I met some of the other astronauts also. So this book, I think, is so inspiring, and I hope everyone, I will talk about it because you have created a really nice idea of taking 50 objects, and with each of these objects, you describe what they mean to the project, but also all the little backstories, and it's just delightful.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, I wanted to select artifacts that really told sort of a nice cross section of that history, and so there's the stories about technology and science, but also social, cultural, political history in there too. And I thought featuring artifacts or telling the history of Apollo through artifacts was a great way to dive in deep into some individual stories and sort of knit them all together to create a larger picture.
Well, now you were yourself a little bit obsessed here with Apollo from a young age, back when you were at MIT.
I've been studying the program for quite a few years, and the history of space flight and astronomy have interested me my whole life.
Well, what an amazing, amazing accomplishment for some. When I first heard your name, I said, Teaselmere Harmony, that sounds like a romance author. And I looked at your picture and I said, well, she's so beautiful. She's not a romance author. She is a doctor and MIT, you are really quite an amazing person.
Oh, that's very nice of you to say.
Wow, it must be a wonderful job just to be able to. I love the Smithsonian so much. I have spent days and days in there.
It is, and it's such a lucky time to be here too. So we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of Apollo. We have a great event coming up really soon to celebrate Apollo 8, which is the first flight to orbit the moon. It's the 50th anniversary of that. That happened in December of 1968. And then next summer will be a really large celebration here in Washington, and probably hopefully around the country and the world. So in July of 2019, it's the 50th anniversary of the first lunar landing. And so it's such an exciting time to be at the Air and Space Museum and focusing on this history. There's a lot going on. So I feel extremely lucky.
Well, why don't you explain for the people in my audience who don't know that much about Apollo, what an amazing project it was. When you think about it, that in such a short period of time, from the time that President Kennedy in 1961 said, we are going to go to the moon, and we did it. I mean, we did it in such a short period of time. And then Apollo, of course, started off so tragically with Apollo 1. So let's talk a little bit, explain a little bit the history of Apollo.
Sure. So when Kennedy first proposed Project Apollo, the U.S. had a total of around 15 minutes of human spaceflight. So Alan Shepard had done a brief suborbital flight in May of 1961. And then a few weeks later, Kennedy proposed Project Apollo. And in large part, it was a response to the Soviet Union's launching of Yuri Gagarin, the first human in space, as well as the Bay of Pigs and sort of the blow to U.S. prestige abroad. And so Kennedy asked his advisors to find him a space program that the U.S. could win, and they proposed this mission to travel to the moon, land humans there, and then send them safely back to Earth. And he proposed it, and in May 1961, and before the end of the decade, that happened. And it took just a huge mobilization, a national effort, the efforts of more than 500,000 people, the development of new technology, new capabilities, building up of a huge infrastructure and new managerial practices, just thousands of technical innovations. It's the scale and the scope of the project is hard to even grasp, and so it's wonderful to have the opportunity to look back into that history and in detail to really appreciate just what people accomplished in such a short amount of time.
Well, essentially it was 2,978 days from the time he said it to the time we landed on the moon, which was, of course, as you said, July 20th, 1969. It's one of those dates that I always remember because although I was very young then, I remember eating pizza at the. I remember having a piece of pizza in my hand when it all happened, and I was thinking, yeah, it's funny. I still, when I eat pizza, I think about it. So it's there. And for anybody who was alive at the time, It was such an amazing, amazing day for us. And for younger generation, I hope, I want them to get this book because they're, you know, we have young people who are interested. They watch Space Trek and Star Wars and all of this. But I think this book might inspire many people to get into some part of science, some part of developing something wonderful. Because artifacts really do bring to life an era.
Yeah, and even just to sort of have sort of bold dreams and set high, big challenges for themselves. So Armstrong had this great line about how that he hoped the first lunar landing would inspire people to believe that things that seemed impossible and problems that seemed impossible could actually be solved. And I think that that's sort of a great lesson to take from Project Apollo. And we have this phrase, you know, if we can send humans to the moon, we can do, you know, X, Y, and Z. And I like that mentality a lot. And I think studying this history and, you know, appreciating the program is a great way to think about, you know, what big, bold challenges should we be taking on and inspire us to do them and to commit ourselves to sort of doing big, bold, great things.
Well, so this was a task that you set yourself. When did you come up with the idea and how did you decide on the 50 objects?
Well, so as part of our planning at the Smithsonian for the anniversaries, we wanted to do a number of things, and so we have a TV series with the Smithsonian Channel coming out, and a lot of different public events and things like that. And we wanted to do a book too, and so I offered to take it on, and I thought that featuring the Smithsonian's collection would be a great way to do that, a great way to tell lots of individual stories. Share stories that maybe people were less familiar with and highlight some artifacts that people perhaps haven't had the chance to see, in addition to some of the great kind of iconic artifacts too, like command module, lunar module. So I thought it was a good access point to that history. And then I really also wanted to highlight a lot of the wonderful scholarship that historians have been doing over the past few decades to help us understand Apollo in a bit more nuanced way. So historians that focus on gender and race and labor and history of computing, and so bring some of those stories to a wider readership.
Well, I thought it was just wonderful that you included, of course, Margaret Hamilton, who was so essential to the space program, and she is not, you know, well known, and she should be because she did amazing things.
She was an extraordinary person, and she's
and she's still alive and kicking, so that's wonderful.
Up in Massachusetts, and credited with coining the phrase software engineering. Was just such a key person in the early development of computing, and helped create a really robust software for Project Apollo, and you know, her work and then also the work of all these hundreds of thousands of people made it possible. But you can, you know, trace those key moments that the work she did contributed to the landing in such a significant way. It's wonderful to shed light on her contribution. And in the book, I have a number of these biographies in addition to focusing on artifacts, because I really wanted to tell the stories of some of the people that were involved in a bit more depth. So there's Farouk Elbaz, who's a geologist who helped train some of the astronauts, or Simon Borgen, who was a science advisor who went with the astronauts around the world on their diplomatic tours, and was involved in some of the sort of foreign relations dimensions of Project Apollo. So focusing on some of the individuals as well as the artifacts.
Well, as I said, when I was given this wonderful grand tour, personal tour guide, Walt Cunningham, and he took me all around Johnson Space Center. And one of the things I wanted to get a feeling for, you know, what it was like. And I had the opportunity to talk to so many of the people, the ones who were working there. And at that time, it was still a very dynamic place. We were still very strong, you know, involved in space. And it was just remarkable how happy all of these people were. I mean, they loved their jobs. Right across the board, every single person there was like, this is the greatest job in the world. And I'm talking because I wanted to talk, and I got a chance to talk to just the ordinary workers there, the people who, you know, cleaned. It was amazing because I wanted little stories to, you know, fill in. When you're writing a movie, you want the little stories of people. And everyone, I'm talking the janitors, would come up and they'd say, oh, you know, they would talk to Walt and they would greet him, and because, you know, he wasn't working there anymore, but, you know, he was always welcome. And how they would tell these little stories about, oh, I remember when you did this, and I remember when you did this. It was this love of being part of something so wonderful.
Yeah, there's a huge sense of commitment and duty, and so many of the people that worked on Project Apollo, they worked around the clock, and they worked on weekends, and they were just so enthusiastic about the goal and participating in such a bold project. One of the artifacts that I chose, because I really wanted to highlight the contract workforce. So with Apollo, a huge percentage of the people that worked on the program were contractors, worked for other companies, and I wanted to highlight some of them work. So I chose Robert Foster's jacket, and so he worked for McDonald and worked at the Cape, and his story is just fascinating to tell, his history, where he came from, where he trained, and his participation. But with Apollo, by the mid-1960s, it was around 400,000 people working on the program, and 375 around 1,000 were contract workers. And so it's just a huge, huge workforce. And we often focus on the people who were working for NASA or the astronauts, but it's it took the participation and the hard work of just so many thousands of people to make that possible.
Well, that's one of the joys of this book, is that you do, in addition to the objects, which we're going to talk about in a little while, we're going to pop through some of them, the most fascinating ones, but it is that you have included the people, which I think gives that excitement of what they went through and what they were, as they were dedicated, and they just, we were all, I think across America at the time, we were all so very proud of what they were doing. And even though there was talk, you know, and there's still talk today, well, why go to space, why? But the peripheral benefits of doing this kind of research, of reaching out and just moving forward, when you think about, you know, the Wright brothers, it was what? Oh, it's December 17th, right?
1903.
Was 1901 or 1903?
1903.
So in just that short time, from 1903 to 1960, what we did. I mean, it's just, it really is amazing.
Yeah, a little over 60 years, and then you think it's been 50 years since Apollo. But what we did in the 20th century, going from the first airplane flight in 1903 to landing on the moon in 69, it's staggering when you think about it.
It is, and of course that brings us to the first object. We're going to talk about a lot of the objects, but let's talk about that very first object that you have in the book, and why it's so important.
It's one of my favorite in the collection. So it's a plaque that has a little piece of wood and a little piece of fabric from the Wright Flyer plane, so the 1903 Wright Flyer. And Neil Armstrong actually brought these pieces of the Wright Flyer with him to the moon. Each astronaut was given what's called a personal preference kit, a little bag. And usually they brought family jewelry or mementos, little flags, patches, things like that. And Armstrong ended up bringing these pieces of the Wright Flyer with him, and he said it was the most significant thing that he had brought in his bag to the moon. And for me, it's it also is really revealing about the important role that artifacts and objects play in our lives, and how they can connect us to the past. So for Armstrong, in 1969, he was connecting his flight to the first airplane flight by bringing these objects to the moon. And then today we can, you know, we have them in the collection at the Smithsonian. They're in, this plaque is in the Wright Flyer, Wright Brothers Gallery. But they can connect us to Armstrong now, and they can connect us to the first airplane flight as well.
Well, it is so beautiful. And when you say they were given a small bag, it was really quite a small bag, because people, unless they've, you know, come to the Smithsonian or Johnson Space Center and actually stood next to some of these capsules, they don't realize how very small they were.
It's wonderful to see things in person to get a sense of scale, because then you can also stand near the F1 engine and be blown away by the sort of the scale of the Saturn V rocket, too. But some things are very, very small. Some things are larger. But this, yeah, it was wonderful that they were able to bring their some things to the moon with them, but they didn't get much space. They had to really choose carefully. And Buzz Aldrin actually ended up bringing a little vial of wine and a wafer, because he wanted to take communion on the moon. That's what he, one of the things that he packed.
Well, that I thought that was a lovely story. And one of the things, of course, wow, when you think, and we're going to talk about these objects, but when you think about how it all started, the first Apollo 1, and what happened, and that we didn't give up, that people were still willing to go.
Yeah, there's a horrible tragedy with the Apollo 1 fire on the launch pad during a test, and the crew perished, and it really shook everyone who was involved in the program, and then also people, you know, around the country and the world. It was a huge tragedy. But some of the good things came of it, which was they worked really hard to make sure to ensure that the spacecraft would be safer, and that they wouldn't encounter the same type of accident in the future. And so the command module was modified. The hatch, which was so difficult to open because it was multiple parts, and the astronauts were trapped inside the capsule, not able to get it opened in time. So they modified that to make it much easier to open, and were able to fix a lot of things. And amazingly, we sent multiple missions to the moon, and everyone survived. And the only major accident was Apollo 13, but the crew still was able to return home safely.
Oh yeah, so, we all know that movie. But Walt Cunningham was on the backup crew for Apollo 1, and I remember when I was working on the script with him, and we got to that part where I was talking to him, and I said. You know, what was it like? Here you were the backup crew. You might have been on that. And that was the only time that he, you know, he's an astronaut and, you know, he's tough and everything. But that was the only time that he got really emotional. And I remember that he was sitting at my dining room table, because he would come up in his Porsche to my house to make it easy for me to write the script. And he was sitting at my dining room table, and just for a moment there, he put his hands together, and he just looked down at the table, and then he looked up, and there were tears in his eyes, and he said that day was so heartrending to him, so emotional, that he still was shaken when he would think of that. Not that he was afraid for himself, but that he remembered that day so it was just there. Always, of all the days, he said that was probably the day that stuck most in his mind, and how very, you know, people would ask him, well, are you going to go ahead? Are you know, is everybody going to stop? It's too dangerous. We can't do this. And he said he remembers all the determination on all the astronauts' faces, and they said, we're going to do this. We're going to show the world that we can do this. We can find the answer. And it was a very emotional time. And I still get tears in my eyes when I think about how he sat there and just felt that pain, you know, even though it was years after. And so it was quite an amazing thing to be able to be involved with that script.
Oh, I can imagine. It was such a tragedy. They had lost their friends, and they're on this risky endeavor. But the story of Apollo 7, his mission, and how they tested out the new modified command module, and a big part of what he was doing with his crewmates is ensuring that future missions to the moon would be safe. And they spent days doing tests and testing the systems and testing the new command module and the modifications, and really,
as he said, 10 wonderful days, 10 fantastic.
Yeah, I bet there were 10 long days too, in Earth orbit and in a small spacecraft about the size of a car. But the crew of Apollo 7 had a huge sense of duty to ensure that these future missions would be safe, and to, you know, in the wake of the Apollo 1 fires. About 20 months later, they were the first American to launch into space, and it was up to them to test the systems that had been
risky. It was pretty amazing. Now, I have to take a quick commercial break, but hold on. And when we come back, we're going to talk about different objects. Of course, we're going to talk about one of the famous and favorite objects, Object 23. Everyone always wants to know about that one. Okay?
Wonderful.
Okay, so just hold on. We'll be right back.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author? An artist? An inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660. Or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels? Each of you has a story to tell, or knows of a story that others would love to read if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers' clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. Sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z, and I am back with my guest, Teasel. I love that name. Teasel Mir Harmony, Dr. Teasel Mir Harmony, I should say, the Apollo curator at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. And this is such a thrill for me because, as I said, I just love this project, and I think you're doing a marvelous job. And with this new book that you've written called Apollo to the Moon, A History of 50 Objects, I think it's going to inspire many people to get involved in the space race, which we are still in. It's amazing. We're still in it. Hi, Teasel.
Oh, it's wonderful to speak with you today.
Well, let's talk about some of the objects that you have. You selected 50, and I will tell you that number 23, as Walt Cunningham told me, this is the question he got all the time. So tell us about Object 23.
Yeah, it's so funny. So, yeah, all astronauts will say one of the questions they get asked most is, how do you go to the bathroom in space? And I think that's because people are just trying to get a sense of what it's like to live in space. What is it like to be there? And it's wonderful to imagine and try to put yourself in the astronaut's shoes. But one of the things people need to know, how do you go to the bathroom in space? And so I chose the urine collection and transfer assembly to talk about, to highlight that. And also it's a slightly less glamorous side of space flight. And there's been some mishaps, some problems. It's a difficult engineering problem to solve. Buzz Aldrin has this funny story about how he may not have been the first person to step foot on the moon. That was Neil Armstrong, of course, but he was the first person to urinate on the moon. Sort of funny. But unfortunately, his urine collection device broke a bit, and some of he ended up being a bit of a mishap. That's for sure.
Oh, I know. That was one of the things when I was, of course, I got the tour, so I got to see all of the stuff, and I got to see everything that they use, and it was so funny. And as Walt said, there are always, I can't go anyplace without people asking me this. But then when you think about it, that, for example, Freedom 7, the capsule that Alan Shepard was in, it's so small. It's like 7 feet You know, it's 7 feet. Hey, you're like a little sardine in there, and it's just an interesting question.
Oh, definitely. And I think for the Gemini program, especially because that was a very compact capsule, and one of the things that the Gemini program was trying to do was figure out what long duration space flight was like and how that would impact the human body. And so you'd have these crew of two people in Earth orbit for days and days and days. There was one flight that was 2 weeks long and very little room to move around in, and there you are doing everything that you do over the course of a day right next to
now people see the space station and people are floating around and going moving around. And it's hard to understand that these, you know, for the Apollo guys, they were in one place for a long time.
Mm-hmm. And very, very little, well, I should say no privacy, actually. Not little privacy, no privacy.
Zero privacy. Mm-hmm. Well, another one that I've always found fascinating was the number four on your list, the stamp. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah, so I
have one, by the way. I have one.
Oh, do you?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, so stamps were often released to commemorate flights, and so both within the Soviet Union and the United States, and actually around the world, there's fantastic space stamps released by perhaps every country commemorating different missions. Really fun to look through those. And I used a comparison of a Soviet stamp featuring Yuri Gagarin's flight, the first human space flight, with a stamp that the U.S. Postal Service released in celebration of the Friendship 7 flight, which is John Glenn's flight. And they're quite different, and they are, I think, really revealing about the differences between the Soviet and the American programs. And so the Soviet program, information about the spacecraft was not shared widely. It was kept secret. And so when there were launches and space flights, those would be announced after it was confirmed that the mission was a success. Whereas within the United States, there was this policy to be really open and invite the press to come view launches. And information about the spacecraft was also shared. And so with the American stamp, in the design of it, they were actually working from engineering diagrams of the Mercury spacecraft. And so it's a relatively accurate depiction of the stamp, whereas the Soviet stamp is it's sort of a rocket ship out of the imagination. It looks more like a sci-fi a ship. And so it's a nice sort of clear visual contrast between the two different programs. One fun thing about the Friendship 7 stamp is they kept it somewhat secret because they wanted it to be a surprise, and they ended up sending a stamp to post offices around the country in sealed boxes, and then with instructions that after the flight they could be opened up and sold. And so it was actually available immediately after the flight, which is the first time that that had happened in U.S. history.
Well, it is. It's a wonderful story because it shows the contrast between America and Russia that's still exists, because we are so open and we so transparent of what we're doing, and it hasn't changed that much in Russia. They still don't want us to know when they crash land, but you know, it's beautiful. And of course, when we sent the Friendship one, what was Friendship, which one, the one that went around for the tour,
Friendship 7.
Yeah, Friendship 7. We sent Friendship 7 all over and let people look at it and let people see it. And perhaps, you know, maybe we shouldn't have. I don't know. Sometimes I like, we're sharing too much, but it is part of our nature. And I think our enthusiasm for what we do great.
Yeah, so right after John Glenn's flight, decided to send the capsule around the world on a global tour, and John F. Kennedy thought that was really an important thing to do, and it would demonstrate the openness of the not only the space program, but democratic values, and sort of represent what he thought were important American values that he wanted to share with the world. And so the capsule touched down in many cities over the course of a few months, and people would wait in line for 3 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours to walk by it and look inside.
It's amazing. It's such a beautiful story when you think of it. So tell us some of the other objects that you particularly love.
Well, I love the model of the lunar module that Walter Cronkite used in his broadcast of the first lunar landing. So the first lunar landing, this was the first live television broadcast that was broadcast around the entire world. So it was the first time there was live television on every continent. And there was an audience of about 500 million viewers, television viewers around the world. And then about half the world's population following the flight through television and newspaper and radio. So it was a global audience, and that's an important part of the history. And then within the United States, 94% of American households watched the coverage on television, and the majority of those people tuned in to CBS coverage and watched Walter Cronkite. And so it's an important part of people's memories. So when you talk to people about, you know, their memories of watching the first lunar landing, it's likely that they were watching Walter Cronkite.
Sitting on the floor eating pizza.
Exactly. And so he used this little lunar module model to describe the different parts of the mission that there was no television coverage for him. So like in flight. So he was well-versed in the different parts of the mission, and he was able to describe to viewers around the country what was going on when they couldn't see it through the television. And he used this model that we have now here at the Air and Space Museum.
Wow. I just when I got the book after I saw that section, I went back and I looked on YouTube and watched that again, and it just reminded me of, you know, my childhood and seeing that. Wow, you know, it's amazing when you think it's really so few years, and we have space stations now. Yeah,
it is incredible to think the rate of technologies that were developed in the 1960s to make lunar exploration possible, and then where we are today, especially when it comes to computing and advancements and computer technology.
Well, and you know, we just landed a probe on Mars a few days ago, and it's all so exciting. And that's why I think this book is so valuable, because it really is a kind of book that if anybody out there, if you have a young person in your family, you know, 12, 14, and put this book in their hands, because it will be inspiring to just to know that there are so many different fields that you can get involved in the space industry. So it's not just that you're going to be an astronaut, but it's the controllers, it's the software developers, it's the people who work on how to go pee-pee in space. It's all of this. There's so many fun things that you can do, one of the things I feel so sad sometimes when people say, well, what am I going to do in the future? What kind of job can I get? What, you know, there's no jobs coming up. But that's the exact opposite. If we embrace this quest to learn more about our universe, it creates jobs. It's an amazing thing, and wonderful and exciting jobs.
Mm-hmm. And there's a huge range. I feature a few different individuals that participated in the program to help not only recognize their contributions, but also to illustrate sort of the complexity, and that there are so many different areas contributing to spaceflight. So Rita Rapp, for instance, who is the Apollo food system technologist and was instrumental in developing the food program, or Simon Borgen, who traveled with the astronauts around the world and helped inform them about the different countries they were visiting, or Farouk Elbaz, who was a geologist who helped train the astronauts to determine which lunar samples they should collect when they were on the moon.
Well, the number of jobs that are available, I think, in the future in the space industry are going to be enormous. And as I said, because the opportunities are open to everybody, it's you know, one of the things I remember talking to Walt about were people of color at the time. And he was saying, you know, we want everybody involved in the space race. We want everybody involved in grasping the opportunity to learn and to grow and to be part of this excitement.
And the workforce was diverse, and probably not as much as it is today, but there was a concerted effort at NASA to hire people from a variety of backgrounds and different races and genders as well.
Yes, that's what he mentions in the book, and he was very proud of that.
And it's something to be proud of. One of the people I feature is George Carruthers, who is an African-American aerospace engineer, and he designed and built the first astronomical telescope that was put on the moon, and a huge contribution and a wonderful way to, highlight the work that he did in the program.
Wow. When you were at MIT, did you ever imagine that you would have this position?
I've been fortunate enough to have a number of different positions at the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum, and I actually started off as an intern many years ago and had different fellowships and things like that. It's a wonderful place to be a space historian, and if you're interested in the history of spaceflight, it's pretty ideal.
But so, you wrote your thesis about the Apollo project, right?
I did, yes. Very interested in the role that Project Apollo played in American diplomacy during the Cold War.
So tell us a little bit about that.
So part of the reason that Kennedy proposed Project Apollo in the first place was as a way to win the hearts and minds of the world public and promote geopolitical alignment with the U.S. So this expectation that something like Project Apollo would encourage other countries to align with the U.S. as opposed to the Soviet Union to choose democracy and capitalism over communism. And there were a number of different ways that spaceflight was employed to help with that mission. So I look at, for instance, the Friendship 7 space capsule tour around the world, the times the astronauts travel the world to visit other countries, things like films and exhibits that were produced and shared with the world, press releases, the Voice of America, radio programs, all sorts of things like that, and the work that went into ensuring that there could be a global audience for lunar exploration as well, so building up that communications infrastructure.
Well, I think you've done just a marvelous, marvelous job. Tell us a few other of your favorite objects.
One of the ones I really, really like is perhaps the least charismatic, but it's the lunar fender repair, and so this is from the Apollo 17 mission, the last lunar landing mission, and they had a lunar rover in this mission, and by accident ripped off part of the fender when they were collecting lunar samples, and this can be really problematic because if lunar dust gets on advisor, it can scrape advisor. It's a little bit more rough than Earth dust, and collects on the spacesuit, and then can inside the spacecraft can get into controls, and can also if it covers instruments, can cause them to overheat. So really, really problematic. And so they had to come up with a solution, and they worked with Mission Control, and much like that story with Apollo 13, Mission Control sort of surveyed all the material that they had on board to solve this problem, and fortunately they had some duct tape with them, and they had some lunar maps that were sort of thick photographic stock, and Mission Control came up with a plan to put a number of the maps together, duct tape them, and then clamp them on to the fender. And then the astronauts were having breakfast the next morning. They gave them the instructions, and they went out and did it and solved the problem. And fortunately, the crew decided to bring this the fender repair home with them. So it worked really well for the rest of their stay on the moon, and they brought it back to Earth, and it's now part of the Smithsonian collection. And you can see it's dusty with the lunar dust, and there's the duct tape, and it's a sort of ingenious solution. It demonstrates some of the teamwork that was necessary to make Project Apollo possible.
Well, it's funny. I just got a new car, and I put a roll of duct tape in my glove compartment. It's sort of always back in the back of my mind. You can do anything with duct tape.
It's true. It's always good to have on hand. It's an important lesson.
And, of course, from Apollo 13, wow, you know, everybody knows the movie so well. This was amazing.
Yeah, and I have a whole section on overcoming catastrophe, overcoming problems. A lot of the rest of the books were moved chronologically, and this is a sort of a thematic section. But I thought it was important to highlight all these different instances where there were these big challenges, and they figured out solutions to them. Because I think that's a fundamental part of this story.
Oh, it is. I want people to get this book, one, because I think what it does is just reinforces that feeling that we can accomplish anything. When you think of what Apollo 13 went through, that even today, I think about it and I can't imagine how they did it. How, you know, with the size of the computers they had in those days, you know, one little handheld computer has more power today than those big computers. And yet they managed to do all of that. It's quite amazing.
It really is. As far as the computers went, they were really, really robust and really innovative. And so even though today our computing power is sort of outstrips what they had to work with, learning more about the systems that they developed at the time is so impressive. And it tells you a lot about how we got to where we are today.
And the people behind the astronauts are really, wow, they are quite amazing when you think about it. And as Walt Cunningham wrote in his book, The All-American Boys, they were a very special group of guys.
Definitely. And they fully recognized that they had taken a huge risk to be astronauts and the challenges that would be involved in terms of the amount of their time that would go into training. So for many of the missions, they would train for 7 to 8 hours per hour of mission. And these are multi-day missions, so that gives you a sense of how much training was necessary for spaceflight. And I think it was the Apollo 8 mission, one of the astronauts said that they thought they had a third of a chance of a successful mission, a third of a chance of going but still coming back alive, and a third of a chance of not coming back to the Earth alive. And so that's, to accept that kind of risk is quite remarkable, and it takes a very sort of a unique person to sign up to be an Apollo astronaut.
And it takes a unique person like yourself to come out with such an absolutely wonderful book. And I want to tell everyone that it's available wherever books are sold. I'm sure in Barnes & Noble it will be displayed, and other bookstores. And it's called Apollo to the Moon, A History of 50 Objects by Teasel Mir Harmony. And it is a book that you should get for yourself and get as a gift. The price is so reasonable as all Nat Geo books, and the production values in this book are particularly marvelous. Just the quality of the paper and the beautiful photographs are amazing. So I want to thank you so much for being on the program today, Dr. Mir Harmony. And if you ever write a romance novel, you can come back too, because I love this name. I get a kick out of this name. It's beautiful.
Thank you. It was a pleasure speaking with you today.
Okay. Well, you know, I have the script of Walt Cunningham's book, novel, you know, that I did the script for, and I probably, it's all hand, he made corrections on it. I probably should donate it to the Smithsonian. How about that?
Oh, it does sound like a wonderful artifact. It's something that should be preserved.
For somebody who loves artifacts, I think it would be great. Okay, so I'll be in contact with you, okay?
Sounds great.
Okay. Yeah. Again, thank you so much for joining me today on Joy on Paper. It was a real joy to talk to you.
A pleasure to speak with you as well.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Okay. Woo! This is nice. This was nice. This brought back a lot of memories. I enjoyed working on the script. Unfortunately, it did what happens so much in Hollywood. It went into turnaround, But it was a wonderful project because I got to meet the astronauts, and I got to see the back part of Johnson Space Center, which was so wonderful. And at the time, it was so big because we were still active in our space race. It's now mostly a museum, but you never know. Maybe we'll decide to get it back up and running and get off, you know, into the wild blue yonder and beyond. So, but it was an exciting time. And that book is available, The All-American Boys by Walt Cunningham, is available on Amazon. So you can still get it, and it's wonderful. And I want you to get this Apollo moon to the moon, Apollo to the moon. Why do I say Apollo? Because my husband is foreign, and he says that all the time, and it's driving me crazy. It's Apollo. I know that. But, you know, what can I do? I just want to tell everyone again, one of the joys of life, you know, is to see your words on paper or to read them in an audible book. And one of the things, the real joy of your life, is to accomplish something wonderful for your family. If you have any time, take that time. I just finished NaNoWriMo, and I wrote a novel in a month. It was really a lot of work because I had to write in the middle of the night because I'm always, you know, I start working at 5 in the morning, and many mornings I started working at 4 in the morning just to do this. And so I've been really exhausted, but I am so proud of myself. I have done it. I will say that it needs quite a bit of editing, but I just let myself go, especially the last few days, because I wanted to just get it done and have that feeling of accomplishment. 50,000 words in 30 days. I did it, and it was fun. I don't think I doubt if I can ever do it again, but I've done it once, and I would recommend it. And I would recommend, if you have an interesting family, and we all have interesting families, sit down and start writing about them, because it's just wonderful for them. For example, at Thanksgiving, for all the family to go back and tell their stories and to just keep a record of your life. It's wonderful. And what else? Next week, next Thursday, Bill Larson is going to be on the program, and he will answer your intellectual property questions. So if you have any, please go to my webpage, radio-joyonpaper, and send me a message, and we will answer your questions. And what else? Meanwhile, make sure you say something nice to somebody today, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything you do for me. He's saluting me. I'm saluting him. That's it. Okay, we'll call it a day, because I was working hard. Okay, bye-bye.